We are in the middle of chapter one, and the chapter started off with this oath that we take before we come down here. It's basically three sentences, but it encapsulates everything about life. So in order to fulfill our mission, to know how to go about it, we have to understand this oath because it's really not so simple. It sounds like it's simple. It's terms that we know, right? Be a tzaddik. Don't be a rasha. Even if the whole world tells you that you're a tzaddik, in your own eyes, be like a rasha. Okay, besides all the questions that we had, how does this make sense? But we also have to revisit the terms. You know, the kids come home from school and they say, yeah, I was learning Chumash today and Hashem made a firmament. Okay, what's a firmament? Yeah, I don't know. So you have to first know the term so that you can go ahead and fulfill the oath. We think we know what a tzaddik is. We think we know what a rasha is. And then we're introduced to this term, beinoni. So we're looking at this oath of be a tzaddik and don't be a rasha. And besides all the complications that we had understanding this, we have to really understand what a tzaddik is, what a rasha is. And once we do, then we can understand the focus point of the Tanya, which is the Beinoni. So we started to say, well, what is a Beinoni? Clearly, a Beinoni isn't someone who's half merits and half demerits. Otherwise, Rabbah would never have thought of himself as a Beinoni. I mean, get real. He's somebody who never stops studying Torah. So he clearly couldn't have mistaken himself as somebody who has half sins. And besides, let's just look at it logically. Whenever could a person be considered a Beinoni? Basically, either they're a tzaddik or a rasha. The time that they're doing an avera, when they're sinning, they're a rasha. If they did teshuva, they're a tzaddik. So when could they be considered a Beinoni? So we're going to look at more and more things that we can say, okay, possibly it's this little thing. Oh, possibly it's that little thing. And we're going to say, no, rasha, 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 and every one of those situations, which makes us understand more why people go ahead and say, yeah, I looked at the Tanya and I can say that, you know, that's what a rasha is. Basically, everybody I know and everybody in my circle. And that clearly is not the message. That clearly is not the message. The Alter Rebbe warns us in the beginning of the Tanya that we are not supposed to consider ourselves a rasha. It's very, very dangerous. If we consider ourselves a rasha, then first of all, we're going to be sad and depressed. Who wants to walk around thinking of themselves as an evil person? Or we'll say, you know what, I can't let it get to me because I can't be sad and depressed. I have to be joyful when I serve Hashem. So, just not going to think about it. I'm not going to think about it. I'm not going to let it bother me. Oh, no, that's what I... Then what do? You become spiritually negligent. So we can't think of ourselves as a rasha. But clearly, when we talk about all the different things that make a person a rasha, you can say, okay, I mean, what else really should I call myself? So let's look at the different kinds of teachers or nutritionists or doctors that there are out there. Imagine your nutritionist really doesn't want to make you uncomfortable or let you down in any way. Because you know what? Just eat whatever you want. And take a couple of vitamins, you'll be fine. Go walking once a month for 30 minutes. I don't want to, like, in any way unsettle you. So that's really nice for the moment. But long term, they're making you very uncomfortable. So it seems like they're trying to protect you and, you know, keep you comfortable and not want to disturb you in any way, but they're not doing you a favor. Or like the teacher who says, oh my gosh, honey, you got a 30 on your math test. Wonderful. How do you feel as a student? It's like, okay, so I'm really a loser. Like, I can't do anything. I mean, my teacher says I'm 30 in a math test. That's very good. Actually, studies show that the teachers who are strict with the students and love them at the same time are the ones who are the most loved. So it's not the teacher who says a little bit, that's good enough for you. No, the teacher says, no, you can do better. That's what the Alter Rebbe is doing for us right here. He's not hiding the facts from us. He's telling us clearly what the facts are. It's not going to do us any good if we think like, yeah, I do this little mitzvah every once in a while and I'm basically a good person and I eat gefilte fish and I'm a great Jew at heart. And that sounds good, but long term, it doesn't do us any good. The Alter Rebbe is literally going to give us the definitions, the descriptors, the things that might make us a little bit uncomfortable, but then he's going to broaden our horizons and he's going to give us incredible tools. So initially you can feel like, oh my gosh, this makes me really uncomfortable. Yeah, for the moment. But once he opens up our eyes, it's not going to be like, oh my gosh, it's such a burden. I can't do this and I can't do that. It's going to be like, oh my gosh, do you know what an amazing thing I do? Every time I say no to my evil inclination, The Alter Rebbe tells us that when we say no to our evil inclination, we literally cause Hashem to take the head of all of it in heaven and subdue it. So our little resistance of not saying something that we really, really want to say right this minute causes global repercussions. Suddenly you start to feel a joy about that. Or when the Alter Rebbe describes what Torah is, literally connection with the divine and a manifestation of Hashem's essence, which literally even the highest world cannot unite with, cannot sustain, cannot manifest, your heart glows. Wow, this is what I get to do when I study Torah. When he describes what a mitzvah is, that we literally become the divine chariot and our limbs express his will, you just soar. So yeah, in the beginning, it's a little uncomfortable. You know, you cannot have all that hydrogenated fat and the food coloring and all that stuff that you thought you wanted to have. But one second, there's a lot better stuff out there. You know, the Rambam, in his introduction to Perek Chelek, which is a section of the Talmud that talks about reward and punishment, Olam Haba, it's called Kol Yisrael Yesh, it's in Sanhedrin, it starts off Kol Yisrael Yesh Lahem Chelek La'olam Haba. All of Israel has a portion in the world to come, and that's why it's called Perek Chelek. And the Rambam then starts to describe reward and punishment and say it's not what you thought about. And one of the things that he says is, imagine a king who, when he was a little kid, he had the pleasure of playing ball on the street. Okay, now he's a king. He can't play ball on the street anymore. Does he feel like, oh my gosh, I can't play ball on the street anymore? No, yeah, he can't play ball on the street. He can't have that little pleasure. But you know the pleasure that he has of being the one in power, of experiencing nobility? He's not going to make that trade. So yeah, there's going to be things that are going to say, okay, we can't do that anymore. But one second, it takes you to a space that's so much higher. Like the mushel, the analogy of the bird who complains to Hashem, he says, it's so unfair the way you made me. You know, all these predators are chasing after the bird, and then I hobble and hobble on those little legs that you gave me. And besides, you gave me two burdens over here that make it so much harder for me to walk. I'm literally limping under the pressure of that burden, one on each side. And Hashem said, those little burdens that you have, one on each side, those are not burdens, those are wings. Spread them out and you're going to fly. So you're going to say, well, all these things I can't do, what a pressure, what a burden. It's not a burden. This is Torah and mitzvahs. This is connection with Hashem's essence. You'll spread them out. You're going to fly. You're going to manifest the divine essence. You're not going to want to play ball on the street anymore. So first of all, we're going to know what the truth is. And yes, it's going to be a little uncomfortable or maybe very uncomfortable. But we're going to move past that, and the Alter Rebbe is literally going to give us a program of revisiting almost everything about life that we thought we knew and understanding it in a whole new way. So back to our different theories of what possibly a Beinoni could be. We're on page 7. So we talked about somebody who's doing a sin. At that moment, they're called a Rasha. Afterwards, they did Teshuvah. Then they're called a Tzaddik. So what about somebody who just went against one of the enactment of the sages? So it's not a biblical prohibition, it's just one of rabbinic origin. Maybe he's the Beinoni. He never ever violated a biblical prohibition, but instead he violated a minor prohibition of the sages. Well, what is he? Va'afilu ha'aiver al iser kal shel divrei seifrim, mikrei rasha kedeisa b'perek beis diyavamais u'b'perek kama denida. Even he who violates a minor prohibition of the rabbis is termed wicked, as is stated in Yevames chapter 2 and in Ibn Nida chapter 1. So over there, they're talking about somebody who does not uphold one of the rabbinic prohibitions, and he's not called kadosh. And the person who postulates that is reprimanded, so to say, and saying that's not the way to put it. When you say he's not called kadosh, it makes it sound like he's not called kadosh, but he's also not called a rasha. No, actually, that's not true. He's not called kadosh, he's actually called a rasha just for violating a minor prohibition of the sages. Okay, so he, not a Beinoni. Now here's something else. Va'afilu mi sheyesh biyadeis limchais v'lay micha nikra rasha v'perek beis deshvois. Moreover, even he who himself doesn't sin, but has the opportunity to forewarn another against sinning and fails to do so is termed wicked, like we see in Shavuos chapter 6. So what about, it's not something that I did. I never violated a biblical prohibition. I never violated a rabbinic prohibition. All I did was I saw somebody that I could have stopped and I didn't stop them. Maybe then I could be a Beinoni. Guess what? Somebody who doesn't stop somebody from doing something wrong when they could have is called a Rasha too. Now, let's talk about it, because some people either hate telling people what to do, and some people love it. They just go around and say, excuse me, did you notice your children left a wrapper on the floor? Excuse me, so you know, right? So here is, this is great. Somebody who does that must be a very righteous person. So it's not that simple, because rebuking somebody is a very serious task. If you are going to rebuke somebody, you have to kind of be sure that it's coming from a place of love, and that person is ready to accept it. The Talmud in Erchin has that Rabbi Tarfon says, Tmehani, I really wonder if there's anybody in this generation, and we're talking about Rabbi Tarfon's generation, this is a colleague of Rabbi Akiva, this is in the times of the Talmud, I wonder, is there anybody in this generation who knows how to accept rebuke? Nobody in this, you can't give anybody rebuke. He said, you tell somebody, take out that splinter from between your eyes. And what does he say back to you? Take out the beam from between your eyes. You just say, like, you know, this little thing, by the way, you shouldn't do it that way. And they say, you're telling me about something small that I did? Oh boy, do you remember that huge thing that they did? Nobody is able to accept rebuke. So Rabbi Lezer
Ben Azariah said,
I wonder if there's anybody in this generation who knows how to give rebuke. It's very nice to say that nobody can accept rebuke, but who actually knows how to give rebuke? In order to give rebuke, that's a really, it's a tough act. I have a great story of my mother because she is just so good at saying what she needs to say in the sweetest way. And people have told me that they made huge changes in their life because my mother just said it like that. But I was a teenager and sitting in the dining room, and she's at the table and she's making a phone call, and she says, hello, Mr. Painter, this is Mrs. Kunin. I just want to let you know you did a terrible job. And I was like, one second, like, mommy. And by the way, you know my mother, she is the nicest, kindest person, okay? And she said, after her phone call, she explained it to me. She said, I'm going to hire him again. So because I'm going to hire him again, I need him to know what he needs to do differently so that I can hire him again. Other people are going to smile and they'll tell him he did a great job, but they won't hire him again. Wow. So there is a certain way to give rebuke. Basically, it's almost impossible. But if you were able to stop somebody from doing the wrong thing and you didn't, you're culpable. You could have stopped something. You could have prevented something and you couldn't, but again, in order to do that, that's a really difficult task. There's a story of the Vizhnitzer Rebbe, Rabbi Yisrael Hager. This was back in Europe. And he went one night, cold winter night, snowing and everything. He goes to visit the bank manager who was Jewish, which was very strange because the bank manager was not a chassid. Not only he wasn't a chassid, he wasn't religious at all. And in fact, he was a prominent member of the Haskalah movement, the Enlightenment movement, which was very much opposed to the religious way of life. And the man was very respectful. He couldn't believe the Vizhnitzer Rebbe is at his door. He lets him inside, brings him into the living room. He says, it's freezing outside. Can I get you a tea? He politely declines. And what can I get you? And you can't get me anything. And he just sits there and he says nothing. 5 minutes, 10 minutes, it's a little uncomfortable. After about 10 minutes, he said, thank you very much for your hospitality, and he gets up to go. And he said, why did you come to my house? He said, I came here to do a mitzvah. Baruch Hashem, I was able to do the mitzvah, and now, good night. I said, what mitzvah did you do? He said, the sages said that just like it's a mitzvah to rebuke somebody who does something wrong, it's also a mitzvah not to rebuke them if they're not going to listen to you. Now, I couldn't do that mitzvah if I'm sitting in my own house, right? I'm sitting in my own house. I can't do the mitzvah. I have to go to the person's house who I'm not supposed to say anything to, not say anything, and then I get the mitzvah. I got my mitzvah. Thank you very much. Good night. So he's like, what was it? He said, I can't tell you. If I tell you, I'm just going to lose the mitzvah. And he was like begging him and begging him and begging him. He said, you know, there's a poor woman who owes money to the bank, and she couldn't pay up her mortgage, and the bank is going to throw her out in the street and take her house. And he said, but why are you coming to me? I'm just the bank manager. It's not me she owes the money to. He said, that's what I was talking about. You know, sorry, good night. And he went back home. He was a man of means, and he couldn't sleep that night. And before the week was over, he paid the poor woman's mortgage. So he found a way of not giving rebuke, but somehow was able to give rebuke. But again, giving rebuke is not so simple. And for those people who thought it was just like a carte blanche that you can just go around and tell everybody what to do, it's not that simple. But if really you could prevent somebody from doing the wrong thing. And I think as parents, it's important to know, like, you know, our children are not the people that we're not supposed to rebuke. We have to direct and guide our children. In this day and age, it seems very difficult. And you feel like, I can't tell my children. You could tell your children, find a nice way of doing it, but we're the people who are meant to guide them and direct them. I mean, Hophni and Pinchas were the sons of Eli HaKohen. And he was like, they were not careful when it came to the karbanos, which parts they took for themselves, the way they flipped it with a fork. And he was held responsible because he didn't tell his children off. So here we're looking at somebody who didn't do anything wrong. They didn't transgress any biblical violation. They didn't transgress any rabbinical violation. But what they did do was they didn't protest when they could have, and it would have been effective. If somebody could have protested, it would have been effective, but they chose, you know what? I don't feel like doing that. I just like, stay out of this. Well, guess what? They're now complicit to the sin and they're called a rasha too. Okay, so what about somebody who had the opportunity to do a mitzvah and didn't do the mitzvah? Maybe they're the banani. V'chol shekein v'kal v'chaymer b'mevatel ezei mitzvahs asei she'efshar lo l'kaima. All the more so, he who neglects any positive law which he is able to fulfill, k'may, kol she'efshar lo la'aseik b'tayra v'enai aseik. For instance, whoever is able to study Torah and does not do so, she'alav darshu rabbeinu zichronam levracha, ki dvar Hashem baza v'gaymer, hikares v'gaymer. To whom our sages have applied the verse, because he has despised the word of the Lord, meaning the Torah, that soul shall be utterly cut off. So we're looking at someone who has the opportunity to do a mitzvah and doesn't do the mitzvah. And a great example for this is the mitzvah of Torah study. Women are obligated to study Torah, but in a different way than men. For men, it's a constant mitzvah. So it's much more difficult for them to fulfill. And for women, our obligation in Torah study is that we're supposed to study everything that we need to know in order to serve Hashem properly, which means we have to know all the halachas that apply. So basically, any man who knows as much as a woman should know would be like a top rabbi out there. All the laws of kosher, all the laws of Shabbos, all the laws of honest business dealings, whatever you need to know, a woman has to be expert in all those laws. And besides, there's the sheish mitzvahs tzmidiyos, the six constant mitzvahs, which are to love Hashem, to fear Him, to know His oneness. You can't possibly fulfill those mitzvahs if you don't learn about it, like in Chassidus by studying Tanya. So there's a lot of stuff that women have to know. But the obligation of constant Torah study is a man's obligation, because women have other time-bound obligations. They're obligated to their families. Then they don't have that mitzvah of constant Torah study. So the Talmud says that there's three sins that are very difficult to avoid every single day. And one of them is not studying Torah when you have the opportunity to study Torah. The other two are avak lashon hara, which is not actual gossip, but it's just getting there. It's like gonna lead to some type of thought or into some conversation, which will become gossip. So basically almost everybody trips up on that every single day. And the other one is concentrating in prayer. If you thought you were the only one who had a hard time concentrating when you were davening, a lot of people have that issue. So here is something that's so difficult to avoid: not studying Torah when you're meant to study Torah. And again, it's important to understand, it doesn't mean that a person can never like breathe. No, the reason why you're taking a chance to have a vacation or a cup of coffee or something that invigorates you is so that when you get back to your Torah study, you're invigorated. So even Hashem, by the way, the Talmud talks about Hashem's schedule every day. And one of the things that Hashem does every day is quote unquote play. It says, Yasin Zeh Yatzarta L'Sachik, by this Leviathan that you created to play with it. So even Hashem, so to speak, plays every day. But what's the point of playing when we relax and we're not studying at that time? We're not engaged in an active mitzvah. It's always for the opportunity to serve Hashem. You know, you have to sleep, right? You can't say, well, I'm never going to sleep because I'm going to study Torah. You need to. You need to be rejuvenated so that you can serve Hashem. But it always has to be with that in mind. I'm doing this in order to serve Hashem. So really, it's very difficult to understand when would somebody be called a Beinoni. I mean, if they do a sin, for sure at that moment, they're called a Rasha. And if they violate a minor rabbinic prohibition, they're called a Rasha. If somebody doesn't oppose or doesn't object when someone else is doing the wrong thing, and they could have stopped them, they're called a Rasha. If they could have done a mitzvah, like for example, study Torah, they didn't do it, they're called a Rasha. So this person who didn't study Torah, ufeshita demikre Rasha, tefei me'aivar iser derabanan. It is thus plain that such a person is called wicked, more so than he who violates a prohibition of the sages. because Torah study is a biblical obligation. Ve'im kein al karchacha ha'benani aim by afilu avayin betel Torah. This being so, we must conclude that the Benoni is not guilty even of the sin of neglecting to study Torah, which is a sin most difficult to avoid and counted among those sins that people transgress daily. That is why Rabba mistook himself for a Benoni. Since a Benoni is innocent, even of neglecting Torah study, Rabba could mistakenly consider himself a Benoni, even though he scrupulously observed even the most minor commandments and never ceased from his studies. So now we have an insight into why Rabba could make that mistake. The Benoni doesn't even have the sin of neglecting Torah study. So really, what's the difference between him and a tzaddik? Neither of them act in a way that's against Hashem. Neither of them speak in a way that's against Hashem. And neither of them even entertain a thought that Hashem doesn't like. So if that's the tzaddik and that's the Benoni, where does the difference lie? And we're going to see that the difference lies in a much more inner space, something that has to do with their core being that makes one of them a tzaddik and the other one a Benoni. Now we're going to look at a note that the Alter Rebbe writes that possibly there could be somebody who has a little bit of sins and they're called a tzaddik and say, no, that's not the case. I know what you're going to do. You're going to bring me this passage from the Zohar and you're going to use it as proof that a tzaddik virale, a righteous person who suffers, who experiences evil in this world, is somebody who has a few sins. And the author is going to say, no, let's look at it carefully and you'll realize that that's not true. Umasha kasav bazaihar chelek gimel daf reish lamed aleph kol shememu atin avay naisa v'chulei. As for what is written in the Zohar, part 3, page 231, he whose sins are few is classed as a righteous man who suffers, implying that even according to the Zohar, the meaning of a righteous man who suffers is one who does have sins, albeit few. And if so, a Benoni must be one who is in part virtuous and in part sinful. So the Zohar tells us that Rav Hapnuna meets Elijah the prophet. And he starts this. He says, possibly a tzaddik virale, a righteous person who suffers, is a righteous person who has just a few amount of sins. And because of his few sins, he suffers in this world. So he shouldn't have to deal with it in the next world. He she'elas Rav Hapnuna le'Eliyahu. This is his question. This is the question of Rav Hapnuna le'Eliyahu, to Eliyahu. He's not saying this as a definitive conclusion. He's asking a question. He's saying, Elijah the prophet, let me know, could this possibly be one of the interpretations of tzaddik v'ralo? He is a tzaddik. He has very few sins and that's why he suffers. But actually, Eliyahu HaNavi answers him and says, no, the tzaddik v'ralo is somebody, if you see him suffering, if you see a righteous person suffering in this world, he's not suffering because of his own sins. He's suffering because of the sins of the generation. So here Rav Hapnuna asks a question. He said, maybe a tzaddik virale is a tzaddik who has some sins, and maybe that's why he suffers. And Eliyahu HaNavi says, no, that's not it. He only suffers because of the sins of the generation, but he personally has no sins. Aval, lafi tshuvas Eliyahu sham. But according to Eliyahu's answer there, perish tzaddik virale hu kumay shekasa b'raya mehemna, parsha mishpatim dele'el. The meaning of a righteous man who suffers is as stated in Raya Mehemna, on Parshas Mishpatim, like we quoted above, that the righteous man who suffers is one whose evil nature is subservient to his good nature. So there's no change in what we've learned. Yes, Rav Hapnuna asked this question, but his question was answered. And the answer is, no, he doesn't have any sins. So what does it mean at tzaddik v'ralei? It's just as we've explored in the earlier passage. Tzaddik, he's a righteous person, v'ralo, and his evil nature is subservient to him. V'shivim panim la'Torah, and the Torah has 70 facets, modes of interpretation. The Rebbe notes that the words, and the Torah has 70 facets, help us understand Rav Hapnuna's question. It's difficult to understand how Rav Hapnuna would even entertain the notion that a righteous man who suffers is one who actually sins, inasmuch as all the above-mentioned questions clearly lead us to assume the opposite. Rav Hapnuna knew everything that we're talking about. So why is he coming up with this theory that maybe a righteous man who suffers is a righteous man who has a little bit of sins? Rav Hapnuna's query, however, was prompted only by the fact that the Torah has 70 facets. And he thought that this was possibly one of these facets. So he knew all these things that we talked about. Rav Hapnuna knew. But he thought, you know what? The Torah has 70 modes of interpretation. Perhaps one of these 70 ways of interpreting tzaddik v'ralo is a tzaddik who has a few sins. But Eliyahu HaNavi's answer to him was no, not according to any of the 70 interpretations can we say that a tzaddik has any sins. Wow. So we realize that the tzaddik is a creature that is very unusual. It can't be what we just always thought it was, that he's, you know, basically good and some sins here and there. So where do we get that notion from? You know, we walked around thinking that a Beinoni is half and half, and we didn't make it up. It wasn't old wives' tales. This is something that has substance from the Talmud. The Talmud talks about judgment on Rosh Hashanah. What does it mean, tzaddik? What does it mean, Rasha? And what does it mean, Beinoni? Beinoni is when it's kind of half and half. That's not something that we've invented, and it's not something that was just like hearsay or rumors. This is something that's posited in the Talmud. So what is that supposed to mean? V'ha de'amrinan ba'alma de'mechta al-mechta mikrei beinoni v'rayv zechuyes mikrei tzaddik. As for the well-known saying that one whose deeds and misdeeds are equally balanced is called a beinoni, while he who has a majority of virtues outweighing his sins is called a tzaddik, hu shem ha-mushal, this is only a borrowed name, meaning a figurative use of the term borrowed from its true usage in order to emphasize a particular point. Thus, the names Beinoni and Tzaddik, denoting a balance between merits and sins, are in fact but borrowed names. So let's look at the way we call things. In Hebrew, we have Shem Ha'etzem. Shem Ha'etzem is a noun, but if we translate it literally, it means the name of the essence. So what is this? It's a table. That's the Shem Ha'etzem. That's the noun. That is what it is. What is it? It's a table. This is a cup. These are lights. All these things, when we're describing them, we're describing what they inherently are. Shem Ha'etzem, the name of the essence, noun. Then we have Shem Ha'to'ar, which means adjective. This means the name of the description. So what does that mean? If we call somebody a wise person or a kind person, it means that, first of all, their shem ha'etzem, their noun, the name of their essence, is they are a person. Now, all human beings have these soul powers. There's the power of intellect. There's the power for kindness, chesed. It could be hidden. But if somebody brings it to be manifest, then when we call them a wise person, it's a true description of their self. Their wisdom has become manifest. It has gone from a state of concealment to a state of revelation. And we're using an honest descriptor of this noun, of this essence. But then there's something else. And that is Shem HaMush'al, a borrowed name. Really, these things could be actual opposites. But the reason why we apply the term from one to the other is in order to hone in on one specific attribute. To kind of take something from that and say, well, we're going to apply it to that, even though they're so different. For example, what's a heart? A heart is a warm, life-giving organ that pumps blood, that is lively, that moves, that's warm. What is a stone? A stone is exactly the opposite. Inanimate, lifeless, motionless, cold, hard. You can't possibly call a heart stone, right? They are exactly opposite essences, and yet we find the term in Yechezkel, Lev Ha'Evan, the heart of stone. Are you kidding? Can you call a heart of stone? That's a really inaccurate description. That's exactly the opposite. This one is porous and soft and warm and life-giving. This one is hard and cold and inanimate. How could you compare? Oh, but there's something about the stone that we wanted to use to describe that person's heart. So of course the person's heart is warm and everything, but they are emotionless. They're mean, they're cold. So it's not truly a stone, but we're borrowing the name stone to point out something about the heart. So now that we know that there's something called Shem HaMush'al, a figurative term, a borrowed name, now we're going to understand why we find this idea of a Beinoni being half and half. It's not a true inherent name. It's not Shem Ha'etzem. It's not that which describes the essence. It's only a borrowed name in order to point out something about it. Why would we use that term? Le'inyan schar v'aynesh, used in regard to reward and punishment. Lefi shenidain achar rubay, because one is judged according to the majority of his deeds. U'mikrei tzadik bedinai me'achar shezecha badin, and he is termed righteous in reference to his verdict, since he is acquitted in his trial. At his trial, it is only in this legal sense that the term tzaddik is applied to one who performs more good deeds than evil. So let's look at somebody who goes to a court case. Okay, in fact, this guy could have been due for capital punishment. But according to the Torah's laws, there's a lot of things that have to take place in order for him to actually get the capital punishment. So maybe he could have deserved it, but it's basically impossible. You know, you hear about the capital punishment in the Torah. It's basically impossible for anybody to have been killed. I mean, they have to be done things almost purposely to get killed because it was just impossible. The warning that they have, the amount of time between the warning in front of witnesses. I mean, the Talmud says that anybody, a Jewish court that killed anybody once in 70 years was called a bloody court. So one death penalty in 70 years makes them a bloody court. So you can imagine that basically no one ever got the capital punishment. But very, very difficult. But let's say this person was on trial for the capital punishment and you would think, hey, he really deserves it, the terrible, heinous crimes that he committed. But he's not, he does not give him the capital punishment. And the Torah says, V'naki v'tzadik al tahareg. Do not kill somebody who was acquitted in trial. They called him tzadik, meaning innocent. But this guy that evaded the death penalty, do we call him tzadik? Like, come on, right? Why are we calling him tzaddik? No, it only means that he was acquitted in trial. We're saying he's innocent. In this court case, we said he was zeicha badin. He, like, won the court case. Doesn't make him a tzaddik. That's how it is in earthly court. That's how it is in heavenly court. So when they look at him after 120 years, or even while he's still soul and body on Rosh Hashanah, the whole world is being looked at carefully on Rosh Hashanah, right? So are they meritorious? Well, let's look. Which side of the scale outweighs? Oh, so they have more good deeds. They have more merits than demerits. Tzaddik. Are they actually a tzaddik? No, it's just a borrowed term specifically for reward and punishment. It's shem hamush'al, but it's not shem ha'etzem. It's not the name of the essence. It's not who they are, essentially. Who a tzaddik is, essentially, we're going to see, is a very specific type of human being. Aval inyan amita shem hatayar v'hamayla shel mailas u'madrega is chaluka is tzaddikim uveinanim. If, however, we seek to truly define the distinct qualities and ranks of tzaddikim and beinonim, let's look at what our sages said. This is what we have to know. Amru Rav Hasenu Zecharenu Levracha, tzaddikim yeter taif shayftan shenemar v'libi chalal bakirbi. Our sages have remarked that the righteous are judged, meaning they're motivated and ruled solely by their good nature. As it is written, and my heart is void within me. She'en la yetzer hara ki haragei betainis. Meaning that he, David, the author of this verse, was devoid of an evil nature, having slain it through fasting. David extirpated his evil nature through fasting. Other ways too are possible. We thus see from the Talmud that the definition of tzaddik in the true sense applies to the person who has rid himself of his evil nature. So we want to know essentially who a tzaddik is. That's somebody who doesn't have a yetzer hara. I mean, that sounds really, really nice. No yetzer hara. By the way, every person starts off with a potential for bad. But some people have this ability to actually do away with it. And David HaMelech said, V'libi chalal bekirbi, my heart is void within me. And the word chalal also means a dead body. He literally had this dead yetzer hara in him because he killed it by fasting. So that's what a tzaddik is. A tzaddik is somebody who is ruled only by their good nature. Aval kol mi shalaihi gi al madregazai, af shezuchu yaisev merubim al avaynaisev, einai b'maylas u'madrega tzaddik klal. But whoever has not attained this degree of ridding himself of his evil nature, even though his virtues outnumber his sins, is not at all at the level and rank of tzaddik. In fact, not only he has not reached the level of tzaddik, he has not even attained the level of beinoni, as has been demonstrated above. So in order to really be called a tzaddik, by the pure sense of the word, you want to know what tzaddik is? No yetzer hara. So that's why we see why the sages said what they said. Lach v'lachin, Amru Rabbi Seinu Zecharenu Levracha Ba'Medrash, Ra'aha HaKadosh Baruch Hu Ba'Tzadikim Shehim Mu'atim, Amad Ushasalan Bechol Darva Darva Chule. That is why our sages have expounded. The Almighty saw that the righteous were few, so he arose and planted, meaning he spread them out, in every generation. Uchamaisha Kasav V'Tzadik Yisayt Aylam. For, as it is written, the tzaddik is the foundation of the world. Thus, in each generation, there must be a tzaddik who serves as the foundation of the world. This paucity of tzaddikim, the righteous were few, can be explained only if a tzaddik is he who has totally rid himself of his evil nature. Were the term tzaddik to mean one whose good deeds outweigh the evil, why then do our sages say that the righteous were few when the overwhelming majority of Jews have more good deeds than evil? I mean, you look around at your friend group, everybody has more good than evil. So then everybody should be called the tzaddik. Why did the Chachamim say that Hashem saw tzaddikim are going to be so few, so he put some in every generation? Obviously, it's more than just being mostly good and having very few sins. There has to be something very different. So up until here, we described these five levels that we're talking about. And it was all an introduction, truly, to the structure of the book that's coming up. So we had all these questions. We wanted to know this oath that we took, be a tzaddik, don't be a rasha. Everybody tells you you're a tzaddik. You still consider yourself a rasha. But what is a beinoni? We heard this term. What does it mean? And remember, this book is a book of beinonim. So now we have some idea that it's not the way that we thought about. And we're going to realize that our struggle comes from a much deeper place than we originally thought. Because until now, yes.
I'm just curious. I thought that tzaddik was just kind of born as a tzaddik, but didn't have that struggle.
So he was born with the potential to be a tzaddik. Okay. Some people are born with the potential to be a tzaddik. Most people are not. So if he tries hard enough, he'll do away with his evil inclination, which is very important. Because some people can say, oh my gosh, see that? I could never be a tzaddik. Did you try? You can only say that I'm not a tzaddik if you actually tried to do away with your evil nature. You follow the program and you realize I still have the struggle. Okay, so now you know. So try it out. And after you try it out and you see that you weren't able to do away with your evil inclination, then you can say, okay, I'm not a tzaddik. Until that, you don't know. There are some people who didn't seem like they could be a tzaddik and then they became a tzaddik. So the tzaddik is born with this potential to do away with his evil inclination. Not just his evil inclination, but to actually either subdue or transform his animal soul completely. So now we're going to look at something much deeper, because until now, we think of a person having one soul and having a good inclination and an evil inclination. It's basically one character, one identity, which has both a drive to do good and a drive to do evil. But now we're going to see that it's not just one soul. We actually have two souls. And it's not just two yitzarim, two drives or inclinations. It's actually two complete personalities, two complete entities within us. If it was just about yitzarim, it would be one soul and two drives fighting over our behavior. But now that it's about two souls, it's about two complete entities fighting over our identity. The animal soul wants us not just to act out of impulse and pleasure and desire, but actually to identify with that. The animal soul wants us to call ourselves by its name. This is who I am. Someone who fulfills all their desires. Carpe diem, enjoy life. It's all about that. You know, all the things that serve me and egocentric, that's the animal soul. And it doesn't have to be bad. It can even just be comfort seeking. And the divine soul wants us to truly identify with our desire to manifest Hashem in this world. That's the identity we should have, that everything about us truly manifests Hashem. So it's very complicated, because again, it's not one person with two drives. It's two complete personalities within us vying for our identity. Now, Kabbalah isn't the only source in Jewish thought that talks about the soul, and even more than one soul. The Rambam, in his introduction to his commentary in the Mishnah, speaks about the human soul, the Min HaMedaber. Ramban Nachmanides speaks about it in his commentary to the Chumash, and so does Rabbeinu Bachai, talking about the human soul. But what makes the perspective of Kabbalah so unique is that it talks about two souls, and one of them which is specific only to the Jewish people. So all human beings have a soul, but only Jewish people have these two complete souls. Literally a divine soul, a part of Hashem above, like we'll explore in the next chapter, and a human animal soul, which doesn't have to be bad. It's just we survive because we have that soul that tells us, eat, time to eat now, have a drink, go to sleep. It's consumed with taking care of the body. It's not bad, and it could be transformed to good, but it's bad in the sense that it doesn't naturally identify with Hashem. So let's get to it. Ach Beir Ha'inyan, however, the explanation of the matter so that we better understand the levels of Tzaddik and Beinoni as well as the various gradation within their ranks. Al pi ma shekasav ha-Rav Chaim Vital Zechreinu Levracha Bishar HaKadusha uve'etz Chaim Shar Nun Perek Beis is to be found in light of what Rabbi Chaim Vital wrote in Shar HaKadusha and in Etz Chaim Portal 50, Chapter 2. De'lechol ish Yisrael echad Tzaddik ve'echad Rasha yesh shtei neshamais, that every Jew, whether righteous or wicked, possesses two souls. This is the base of all our struggles. You say, why do I struggle so much? I think I'm so hypocritical. I'm a hypocrite. One second I want to do the most amazing, amazing things. I want to literally change the world for good. I'm like a champion for every good cause on planet Earth. And the next second I'm doing something that I really don't think is the right thing. Screaming, losing my patience, judging somebody unkindly. What a confused personality I am. No, one second. But there's not one person who's a hypocrite. There's literally two souls within you, and this is the key insight to all of our struggles. Dichsiv uneshamais ani asisi, as it is written, and nishamot, souls which I have made. So this is a verse from Yeshaya, and the pasuk ends saying, ki ruach milfanai ya'ataif uneshamais ani asisi, and the way Tzvi Friedman translates it is, when a spirit emerges from within me and clothes itself in a body, I have made souls. So the verse is speaking of an individual Jew, as indicated by the singular form of the word ruach, spirit, in the preceding phrase, when the spirit of a man, which emanates from me, will be humbled. The plural term souls is nevertheless used, indicating that every Jew possesses two souls. So there's one spirit that emerges from within me, and I have made souls. So this one person has two souls. Shehein shtei nefashes. These are two nefashot, two souls, two life forces. Nefesh achas mitzad haklipa v'sitra achra. One soul originates in the klipa and the sitra achra. Klipa means the shell or peel. God created forces which conceal the godly life force found in all creation, as a peel covers and conceals a fruit. Sitra achra means the other side, the side of creation that is the antithesis of holiness and purity. The two terms are generally synonymous, and they're actually not synonymous. They define different things about the forces of evil. So instead of going into it this class, because I want to give it a full treatment, we're going to go into it next class. But Ezra Sashem, let's sum up what we said until now. So we're trying to do our mission in life. And we have to know what are the goals and what are the markers, and we have to redefine the terms. Because clearly, a Beinoni is not someone who has half sins and half merits. Oh, so what is a Beinoni? Maybe he is someone who just violated a minor prohibition of the sages. No, look in the Talmud. He's called wicked. Okay, maybe he's someone who was able to stop someone from doing a sin and didn't do so. So he himself didn't sin, but he didn't stop someone else from sinning. Well, if you were able to stop someone and you didn't stop them, he's wicked. Okay, maybe it was somebody who didn't use a mitzvah opportunity, like someone who could have studied Torah but didn't study Torah. Nope. He too is considered wicked, and it's even worse than someone who violated a prohibition of rabbinic origin. So now we're going to realize that if all these people are called Russia, and again, please think about what we said in class and don't just go ahead and call yourself a Russia because it's the wrong thing. If all these people are called a Russia, and it makes it very clear that it's kind of hard not to be a Russia, we have to say, we're forced to say that the Beinoni isn't even guilty of the sin of neglecting Torah study when he had the opportunity. And now we could understand, why did Rava call himself a Beinoni? He said, for example, I am a Beinoni. He was able to make that mistake because a Beinoni is so similar to the Tzaddik. When it comes to a behavioral level, they're identical. They're exactly the same. And yes, I know the Zohar talks about Rav Hamnuna saying a tzaddik v'ralo possibly is a righteous person who just has a few sins. But if you look at Eliyahu Hanavi's answer there, he told him, no. He's not suffering for his own sins. He's suffering for the sins of the generation. What is a tzaddik v'ralo? It's exactly what we said before. A righteous person whose evil nature is subservient to him. And yes, there are 70 facets to the Torah, but even according to any one of these facets, that's not a tzaddik v'ralo. He doesn't have any sins at all. So why are we saying half and half is a Beinoni? We've seen that expression before in the Talmud. Oh, that's not the real term. That's not the Shem HaEtzem. It's not the essence of it. It's just Shem HaMush'al, a borrowed name. It's figurative. When we're talking about whether or not they were victorious in their judgment, then we say, okay, so their merits were more than their sins. So they're tzaddik bedinai. They are righteous in judgment. That's only figurative for this court case. But are they essentially a tzaddik? No. If we really want to know what a tzaddik is, then let's look at what the sages said in the Talmud. They've quoted this verse from David HaMelech in Tehillim. He said, "V'libi chalal bekirbi, my heart is void within me." Why was it void? He didn't have a yetzer hara. He started off with one, but he killed it. So a tzaddik is somebody who has no evil inclination. He's only judged by his good inclination. And now we can understand why our sages said that Hashem saw that tzaddikim would be so few, so he spread them out in every generation. If it's just about having more merits than sins, it can't be so few, thank God. There's many, many, many tzaddikim by that criteria. But obviously, it's something deeper. It's somebody who doesn't even have an evil inclination. And that's why there are so few of them. Now we started to talk about the essence of the struggle. Everything we talked about, ach, be'er ha'inyan. Okay, now we're going to explain it all. Where does all this come from? All the struggles that we have. Oh, you know why? Because you have two souls. You thought you were like one simple, maybe you didn't think of yourself as simple. You thought you were one complicated hypocrite. No, no, you're not. You're a perfectly healthy Jew, and you have not one soul, but two souls. The first of these souls originates in the side of impurity. And that's something that we're going to visit next class, Bezrat Hashem.